thank you for taking some time and allowing us to have a committee meeting after the deadlines. But I before we get started, I want to thank the conferees that came late last night to sign a conference committee report. And I think that that'll get the education finance bill moving, and I believe it will be taken up this morning during session. I don't know the exact timing of it, but I what happened last night was that they took the education component, and that'll be moved as a separate bill apart from the other finance package that we have. Mr. Nauman just mentioned that it'll start in the House because it's a House file. So, and then it'll come over to the Senate. This morning, what I'd like to do is take a little bit of time. And as I mentioned on the floor, we've been having some issues popping up in other bills. The tax bill, the overall budget bill, I think as a committee, treasure the jurisdiction of the committees that we have, that we serve on. And obviously, when bills end up in other committees, we have no basic say over those, what's going on in those committees, and would like to be sure that our colleagues and other committees and other chairs respect the work that gets done in a committee. And one of the issues which we had requested, but the bill ended up in the tax committee, we were able to pull that bill into our committee because it went to the tax committee, and then last night, I believe it ended up in the tax conference committee. And that was a bill relating to the school lease purchase levy, which is a statute, 126.40, which allows school districts to do a number of things. And so we've invited Dr. Melcher to go over that. We also, I believe, have the superintendent from the Duluth School, which are using, the Duluth School District is using this option as part of a plan to do some facilities development. And so we would like to have that issue explained to us, because not all of us are as familiar with that as possible, but also find out what impacts, what you go through, what school districts go through, find out what the process is, and then also if there are impacts from what's in the tax bill on what the plans that the district had originally put together. So I guess what we'll do is, we probably don't have control over the tax bill right now if it's closed up, but I want to be sure that other people and other committees and other chairs understand that there is a jurisdictional issue here where we should have dealt with it and not the tax committee. And so we'll ask Dr. Melcher to go through that and explain what's going on. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Program Finance Director at the Department of Education. And I do have a handout for you that's labeled Financing of Duluth's Red Plan that I would like to use to maybe explain that. This is information that's taken from the review and comment that we issued to the Duluth School District. The combination of a variety of projects that were all included in one review and comment request from the Duluth School District came to a total of $293 million, financed with three primary funding sources. And I just want to put in perspective the lease purchase part of this as it relates to the other parts of the plan.
Excuse me, just before you get into it, Senator Solon, would you like to join us? I'm sorry, I was kind of looking around for you. Please join us here. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, the first part of the plan was the board-approved issuance of about $59 million in 20-year general obligation bonds under the authority of Minnesota Statutes 123B59. That's the alternative facilities statute, and that applies to, I think, 21 large school districts that can issue bonds or do annual levies without voter approval for deferred maintenance and health and safety and disabled access projects. So that part of the plan came to about $59 million, and I'll walk you through how that affected different schools in Duluth. And the second part of the plan, of the financing plan, involved the lease purchase agreements of about $171 million, and this was used for projects that did not meet the criteria for or did not necessarily meet the criteria for the deferred maintenance or health and safety that would be allowable under the alternative facilities statute. And the third part of the plan was to do a 20-year installment lease agreement of about $35 million using funds from the sale of unused district properties and some other savings that the district was accruing because of the changes in the closing of the schools, et cetera. Some more efficiencies from the new systems that they were doing. When the review and comment came to the department, the commissioner approved most of the plan, but did not approve two new schools that were not far enough along in the planning stage for the commissioner to act on. So that was about $68 million, and those two new schools were to have been funded with this lease purchase levy. So the amount that was approved under the lease purchase levy was $111 million as opposed to the $171 million that the district had in their initial plan. And they were asked to do some more work on that piece and then come back when they had more information. If you turn to the second page of the handout.
Could you clarify whether the board-approved lease purchase amount is under the current authority or the expanded authority that's being proposed be required in order to raise that amount?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, all of these were approved, were requested under current law.
Okay. Dr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman and members, if you turn to page 2 of the handout, this is a summary of the different facilities project that the school district proposed to the department, and you can see it affects a large number of schools, and there are several different funding sources. So this is a pretty complex project involving facilities throughout the district, and you can see the different facilities are listed going down, and the funding sources are listed going across. And so the first four columns relate to the alternative facilities funding sources, and there was a total of $66 million in projects related to alternative facilities, including deferred maintenance, disabled access, and health and safety projects. And those are funded with the same funding source used by basically the 21 largest districts in the state to fund those kinds of projects. And the next column over is the lease levy, and this is the one that is under Minnesota Statutes 126C40 that we'll get into more detail on. But the district had actually proposed $189 million in projects under that authority. And because the department pulled out the West Middle School at $43 million and the let's see here, the new Piedmont Lincoln Elementary at $16 million. That reduced the total projects that were actually approved in the review and comment down to $121 million. And then because the district was going to use some interest earnings to pay for part of that, the actual lease purchase levy related to that was about $111 million. So that's how those pieces fit together. And then the general fund savings that you can see, which includes the sale of property, was about $38 million in projects to get over to this $293 million that was requested. And then you can see with the two schools that were pulled out, it came down to about $225 million. So that's just to kind of try to put in perspective the scope of all the different projects and what the different funding sources were.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Melcher, can you just, there are four new school projects listed in the lease levy column, the two that you mentioned, the middle school and the elementary, but there are two others. It says new, Lester Park and Lower Mac, that were part of the approval. What is the difference in those four that suggested two of them were to be approved under the lease levy authority and two were not? Could you just talk about that?
I think the primary difference, Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, was that the two that were approved were at existing sites, and they were basically, for example, Lester Park, they were going to replace the existing facility with a new facility, and we knew exactly what the site was like. In the case of the other two, there was still some discussion and debate as to exactly where those would be located. There hadn't been testing of the sites and that sort of thing. So they just weren't as far along in terms of selecting the facilities, and I'm sure Dr. Dixon could go into more detail if you wanted on that. But we just didn't feel like the district was quite ready in terms of defining exactly what the project was in those two new ones. Mr. Chairman, I thought it would also be helpful for you to put in perspective on page 3, you can see the historic use of the lease purchase levy. It's been used by four school districts in the state. This shows the history for the past two levy cycles. For taxes payable in 2008, the Minneapolis School District is levying $31 million under this provision. Rochester, $1.3 million. St. Paul, $9.3 million. And Duluth, $6.554 million. You can see the Duluth levy is quite a bit larger in Pay 08 than Pay 07 because of the anticipation of these new projects coming online. The others are pretty stable where they're at. And you can see the tax rates as well. And you can see in the case of Duluth, the tax rate's about 8.8% of tax capacity, and the one that's closest to that is Minneapolis at about 6.6% of the tax capacity. In terms of projects funded, in Minneapolis, there's been about $275 million of projects funded with this program, including several new facilities and some renovations at other facilities. In the case of St. Paul, also been used for several new facilities and constructions. This is kind of listing some of those facilities. In Rochester, it's been used for an addition on the John Marshall School and also Longfellow School and for technology, computers in the district. And in Duluth, the previous use had been for $7.9 million for a secondary technology center. So this gives you kind of historically where this has been used. There are other school districts under the statute that would be eligible, but it has only been these four districts that have used the law up to this point in time. And, Mr. Chairman, the last page of the handout is Subdivision 6 of Minnesota Statutes 126C40 at the top of the page. And then at the bottom of the page, I have listed the desegregation revenue law because it helps to kind of cross-reference what clauses we're talking about here. And the version of this that I'm using, Mr. Chairman, is the version that's included in Senate File 3001. We did, as a result of going through the Duluth project, notice that there was some technical updating that was required of the law, and so we thought it might be easier to walk through this, including those technical updates, so you can see how this relates to the different statutes. And so 126C40, Subdivision 6, is a subdivision in the lease purchase statute that the normal piece of the lease purchase statute is limited to $100 per pupil. And the legislation that you're looking at this year would increase that to $150, but under current law, it's limited to $100 per pupil. What subdivision 6 does is allow school district with a desegregation plan to exceed that $100 levy limitation for lease purchase under certain circumstances. And the current language in 126C40 is, well, if you go to line 49.9 of the Senate file 3001 here, you can see it defines certain districts, and then 4910, it allows the districts that are defined to do a purchase of real or personal property under an installment contract or a lease purchase agreement, and that does not require voter approval. And the way that this law works, if you go down to line 4922, you'll see that the word district is defined, and we have some new language here that's underlined that's clarifying the existing language, but we have not changed the purpose or intent. What it does is it divides the world of desegregation districts into three groups. It took the three cities of the first class, which are defined in clauses 1, 2, and 3 of the desegregation law, which is on the lower half of the page. And for those districts, it simply allows those districts to do a lease purchase without voter approval. For other districts that have a desegregation plan, and this is down on line 4929 and 4930, and the critical piece of this is where it says on line 4929, and for a district eligible for revenue under 124D86 subdivision 3 clause 4, and then we've inserted clause 5 as a technical correction. When this law was originally written, it included only clause 4, and clause 5 was added later. This was never fixed. Where the acquisition of property under the subdivision is determined by the commissioner to contribute to the implementation of the DSEG plan. So that clause, the part about requiring the commissioner to evaluate whether this contributes to the desegregation plan, applies only to the districts that have a DSEG plan under clauses 4 or 5, which are the districts that are not districts in cities of the first class, that are considered the core cities in terms of having racial isolation or racially isolated schools. So, for example, Rochester or Wilmer would be in a situation where they would, if they came in to use this levy, they would have to show that this would contribute to the implementation of their desegregation plan. But the way the law is written, Duluth did not have to pass that test. And then the third part of the law, down below on line 4932, if you have another district that is participating in a joint program, then they can only levy under this if we're talking about a joint facility. So, for example, if we were going to do a magnet school involving suburban districts along with Minneapolis or St. Paul, then those suburban districts could only levy if it was for a joint facility to be shared with the core city. So those are the three breakdowns in current law. The language in Senate File 3001 doesn't change the intent. It just updates the cross-references to reflect the current DSEG rule and the current clauses that we have in the integration revenue statute.
So each of these proposals relating to different districts would have to go through an approval through the department?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Anytime there's any sort of construction project by a school district that's more than $500,000, it requires a review and comment from the commissioner. And the depending on what clause applies within this statute, the standards for the review and comment would differ. So in the case of Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Duluth, under this particular statute, since it doesn't require them to link the construction project with the desegregation plan, we go back to what the normal standards are for school leases. And those are actually on the very first page of the handout, about halfway through the paragraph dealing with lease purchases. And that includes reasonableness of the price, appropriateness of the space to the proposed activity, the feasibility of transporting pupils, conformity of the lease to state laws, and the appropriateness of the proposed lease to the space needs and financial condition of the district. So those are the standard criteria that we use for any of the lease levies that we have for districts throughout the state. And those are the criteria that would have applied to the Duluth School District as they did their proposal. If we had gotten a proposal from Rochester or Wilmer, it would have been a different set of criteria because of the way this law works.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Melcher, could you comment a little bit on the projects in the Duluth plan, on the large handout we have that is the 126C.40 subdivision 1 paragraph C that talks about that this may not be used for newly constructed buildings. Are the buildings in the Duluth plan newly constructed? Whose primary purpose is, how does paragraph C apply to what the Duluth plan is?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, subdivision 1 is the standard, the authority for the standard lease levy limited to $100 per pupil that applies to all school districts in the state. And the Duluth plan does include some new construction as well as some renovations of existing buildings. So Duluth would not have been allowed to have used subdivision 1 to have done that new construction. But they're not relying on subdivision 1. They're relying on subdivision 6, which does allow for new construction and has, in fact, as I've indicated on page 3 of the handout, has been used for new construction in Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Chairman, Dr. Melcher, on the Minnesota Statute 126C.46, subdivision 6, down on line 15.1, 2, and 3, it says notwithstanding subdivision 1. I don't know if that's the subdivision 1 you're referring to on this long page. That's
yes.
26.40, that the prohibition against a levy by a district to lease or rent a district-owned building to itself does not apply to levies otherwise authorized by this subdivision. So in other words, they can just build the building and lease it to themselves.
And pay for it through this levy.
Which is the same thing as being able to just have a non-voter approved levy and building the building.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, yes, and that's essentially what's being proposed here. They do have to go through review and comment with the kind of standard criteria for review and comment, but this does allow the district to proceed with construction of a new building without voter approval under the subdivision 6.
And Mr. Chairman, what was the rationale of that, of what distinguishes the districts that are allowed to do that versus all the rest?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, this goes back quite a long ways, you know, probably back to the mid to late 80s, and I don't have a recollection of all of the rationale behind the law, but I believe there was a belief that the cities of the first class had some special challenges in terms of maintaining their buildings and meeting building space, and given the large size of these districts, being able to pass bond issues to do that, and I think this was given to them as a way of ensuring that the core cities were able to maintain adequate facilities.
Members, I believe the language that came into the PAC committee from the House side had a different provision or a new provision that would have impacted relating to a reverse referendum. And Mr. Nauman, maybe you can explain it further.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is the House File 3149 third engrossment language that you have in your packet. And this is what was included in the House tax bill as it came into the Tax Conference Committee. In the original bill authored by Representative Yaros, and I think it was carried by Senator Bach in the Senate, and it's in the Tax Committee now in the Senate, there was some concern that that language was not specifically limited to the Duluth School District, which was, I believe, the author's intent. So this language that you see here limits it to the Duluth School District and permits the school district with a board meeting to propose a plan of this type. But then if 15% of the registered voters at a petition request a reverse referendum, then a reverse referendum would be allowed. Now, it's my understanding, I didn't sit in on all the Tax Conference Committee negotiations, but they did, there was some opposition to that reverse referendum mechanism, and I do have the language that they ultimately adopted last night, if you'd like to take a look at that. This What you have in your packet is what was brought into conference committee. I have here what they ultimately adopted, which is different, and we can hand that out now. So, Mr. Chairman and members, the language that you're seeing now is the RDR 0112 amendment, which says, notwithstanding the permanent law that that Dr. Melcher has just talked about, and then there's some fancy language that just limits this to Duluth, it prohibits the district from levying more than the amount necessary to service $125 million in bonds. It is my understanding there's been some conversation in the Duluth area, and you may want to probe this a little bit with the superintendent when he testifies, that there's been conversation that this specific statute, that they would not be levying more than the amount necessary to service $125 million in bonds. So what the tax committee, conference committee agreed to do was to place a limit on that point. So you can't levy more than that amount. Then the remaining part of the bill, or the language on lines 1.8 through 1.11, ties it specifically to the plan that Dr. Melcher referenced. And so it's not anything else that the school district has. And then the effective date applies retroactively to any bonds that the district sold after November 30th, 07, to pay for the district's long-range facilities plan. So I think what they're doing with this language, instead of doing the reverse referendum or a broader change to the 126C40 sub 6 statute, is just allowing the district to go ahead with its plan, but tying it very tightly to $125 million of bonds and the levy to service those bonds.
If I understood your page 2, that this language would pretty much limit Duluth's plan to not include those two new schools, because you needed it looks like you needed $121 million under the existing plan that you have, mm-hmm. and you'd need. And you'd only have authorization under this for $125 million, so that wouldn't leave enough difference to include those other two schools. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, if I'm reading this correctly, I believe you're correct. The what's already been approved by the commissioner was the basically $111 million in lease purchase for the $121 million in cost, assuming there was some interest earning. So this is 125, I think, is a little higher than the 111. It allows about 14 million, it looks like. The project cost was 121, but the lease purchase was a little less because there was an assumption that there would be some interest earned. And the Duluth people may have a better handle on this than I do. So this looks like it would allow about 14 million over what is needed to take care of what's already been approved, but certainly not enough to cover the two new schools. It might be enough to come close to the elementary there, but not the elementary and the middle school. And the other thing, Mr. Chairman, I would just say as a technical thing, that technically these are not bonds, they're certificates of participation, which are a little different terminology. So that there might need to be some technical work done on this as well.
Maybe this would be a good time to invite the superintendent. Is Mr. Dixon or Dr. Dixon?
Good morning.
Good morning. Before you start, I think Dr. Melcher, I think the committee wants to extend their appreciation for all your help and work throughout the year, and you know, it's always enlightening when you get up and talk. You always have a very precise and well-organized presentation, so we appreciate it very much. Dr. Dixon?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me today to try to give you an overview of our project in Duluth and then perhaps answer specific questions that you have. Just to start with, to give you an idea, we were talking about the review and comment that was submitted to the Department of Education. I pulled it out just so you could see the size of it in terms of what that looks like to present a review and comment project, like the scope of what we're talking about here, just so you're aware. Let me give you a quick overview, perhaps, of what the circumstances in Duluth, and then certainly what the intent was in this project, and sort of where we are today quickly. First of all, the issue of Duluth in terms of facilities has been an ongoing, long-standing issue for actually decades. If you know anything about Duluth, we went from 22,000 students down to about 9,600 students today. That has been really hard and devastating, as you can imagine, for the community. And while we have been successful over that period of time of closing some elementary schools and one small high school, we've really never been successful in saying, okay, we've got to really look at this district in terms of the number of facilities that we have. We're running three large comprehensive high schools, an alternative high school, four middle schools as an example. And so the secondary piece of this has really been challenging for the school district. And you can imagine why. I mean, anytime you try to close a high school in the community with long-standing tradition, it's never easy to do. And so there have been many, many attempts in Duluth to offer plans to, in fact, deal with this long-standing issue. And they have not been successful. In fact, there have been at least two other options in the last decade alone of trying to deal with our long-term facility issues. In the meantime, as you can imagine, because of that, our investments in our facilities has been very limited, in part because not having a clear direction of which facilities to invest in as a long-term solution. Our buildings on average are 54 years old. When we did an assessment of our facilities, we found that over 60% of the facilities themselves don't meet current code in terms of building code. We have real issues, as a lot of schools do, with air and water quality, handicap accessibility, support for modern programs, as you can imagine, along with the issues that all of us deal with today in terms of how schools are constructed to provide security for certainly students and staff in the community. We also learned in our process that we have over 500,000 extra square feet than we need. As you can imagine, that's a lot of extra square feet to maintain, own, clean, all those kinds of things. Because of the challenge in our district and the numerous attempts, when we started working on this project, we heard a number of things from the community. We need to do it right. We need to be data-driven, do it in the right way. We need to involve the community somehow so that we can bring them along with us so that there would be general support for the plan when we ended. And we heard pretty clearly there can't be any do-overs this time. And the reason for that is just the emotional stress that's been on this community for decades and numerous attempts to get this done. And so to get that done then, in short, this isn't like rolling out a plan and saying, and have the board approve it. In fact, far from that. What happened this time, we took 16 months to get to a plan. 16 months, and it started with a community group made up of 35 citizens from across the community. Not selected by me, by the way. The first 14 were selected by the board, and then they grew their own committee, so that didn't have sort of the administrative flavor to it of who was supporting the community. During that time, we held over 120 community meetings relative to the plans. We held 12 what we'd call the New England town meetings, large participation of people to come and be involved with the plan. We had multiple communications of information going out and information coming back. We used websites, parent portals, every means we could to figure out how to get information out to the community and to get it back. In fact, toward the end of the process, we also, to verify where we were in the process, we involved Decision Resources quickly in that to do a community-wide survey. They surveyed over 600 people in our community, and what we learned is that almost 80% of the population was well aware of the plan, and of those, 63% said they were very familiar or somewhat familiar with the results. And we learned that, because we submitted three alternatives to the community for consideration, we learned the plan that we actually adopted by the board had over 81% of the residents supporting, which is a two high school plan. We looked at a one high school plan for our community, and we looked at two plans where we remodel an existing high school and an existing middle school to make them high schools, and we looked at a plan with new high schools. The plan that was actually adopted was a remodel plan. One of the things we wanted to do was use as much of the square footage as we could. So ultimately in the process then, to give you an idea of the things that were studied, we did do a facility assessment. We brought in 40 analysts, 18 different firms from our community that went through every bit of our buildings. We produced a 1,600-page report showing over $200 million of deferred maintenance alone in these buildings. We used the Department of Education standards for what facilities need to look like for the future. We did what was called a facility assessment for educational purposes, and through that identified another 40-some million just to figure out how to use these facilities as best we could. We also then looked at demographics to make sure we were right, even though there were previous demographic studies done, and those verified that we are leveling out. We expect to level out about where we are today, and while we grow slightly, there isn't anything to suggest that Duluth, in terms of student population for the next 20 to 30 years, should stay around the 9,600 to 10,000 student range. And so based upon that information, we really started to put together, as I said, three different alternatives for the community consideration. I think the important thing is this. When we have done studies in the past and did studies this time and looked at our community, and one of the weakest areas was, in terms for us, was the view of the Board of Education. As you can imagine, going through this over multiple decades, and what we had seen in the past, there have actually been plans submitted that the board voted on and approved to close some schools, only later on to turn around and then, because of the community pressure and outcry, to change their mind. And so one of the things we heard early on in this process was, if we go through this process together, will the board stay the course? Can they stay on task here and do the plan as we put together? The other thing we heard from the community, because of the challenges in Duluth, if you know anything about Duluth, there's a lot of sensitivity to adequacy, but also equity across the district. We felt, and what we heard from the community, is not only could you close buildings, but could you upgrade our buildings and provide equity across the district, from east to west primarily, within our schools. And so what this plan does is it is a comprehensive plan. It's looking at all facilities. We didn't want to just simply say, well, we'll do one piece at a time without a long-term vision of how the whole community would be affected. We felt that would be most efficient in the long run for us as we looked at our school district as a whole. There is a lot of support for this plan. A letter was submitted, co-signed by the Chamber of Commerce. We've had strong support from the Chamber community, and we have strong support for labor. In fact, both of those groups were strongly involved with helping to create the plan. And so really where we are, the board did approve the plan. We've actually sold about $69 million in alternative facility bonds at this point. We were scheduled to sell another $111 million during April or May. We have simply held that until the result of this legislative process is complete. We actually have, at this point, bid two of our elementary schools, and the boards approved those bids, and we're moving forward with construction this summer with two of the remodels at Stowe and Lakewood. In our plan, we needed to meet some standards for square acreage in our schools. We needed to purchase 41 properties, and as you know, that can be challenging with the community. We already have roughly 25 of those purchased in our process so far. That's going very well. Through the board's leadership, we've been able, I think, to try to think about a process that is fair to the property owner. And certainly, while you never know, our goal is to try to avoid eminent domain, as an example, with those property owners. And I think we would have more done at this point, except that it takes a while to get the appraisals done and so forth on these properties. So that's a quick update relative to where we are. We are seriously concerned about the legislation that's been proposed. I'm concerned that it does limit the board's authority. And at this point, I really believe the board in Duluth needs that authority to be able to move forward. They have been courageous. They've stood in the box on this project because they know from beginning to end they've been involved in the project. And so we're very concerned about the legislation that has been proposed. One of the pieces, and Dr. Melcher mentioned it, that I think has been part of the discussion, just to clarify, when you look at the lease levy authority that we were authorized, part of this piece is paid for by savings within the district. By being courageous and closing the number of buildings and upgrading our buildings, we can save, documented, about $5.4 million annually in savings in our general fund budget. About half of that is in energy savings, and the other half is in less personnel. Because as you know, it takes a lot of personnel outside of the classroom to keep extra buildings open, like principals, assistant principals, and secretaries, and so forth. So our plan to help the taxpayer was to buy down that piece of this plan so we could make it cost effective for the taxpayer. Visualize the massiveness of this project, and for an average home in Duluth right now, it's $10 a month, $9 and something. So taxes actually went up to about $120 on a home in Duluth, and then from then on it goes up about $3 annually per year for 20 years. So the community can get all remodeled or new schools for about $10 per month. However, I wanted, and the department, I think, too, wanted to give the board as much flexibility as necessary for the future. So if you look at our lease levy authority, it has more than necessary to do the plan. The idea was to give the school, the board, some flexibility on their $5.4 million in savings, that they could put some on the program side and some to pay down the debt. So in this plan, we use about $1.4 million for sure to buy down the debt on the lease levy side. The difference is an annual board decision. So I do believe there is concern about saying, well, in essence then, the board could say pass a local levy on the operating side for learning, and then also move another $4 million over annually to the program side, which indeed would up the tax side on the capital investment side. And there's been discussion about that in our community. I thought that what I understood was perhaps that what we were trying to do in legislation would be bring that lease levy authority back down to a level that simply funded the plan. It would take some, what has been granted to us, some local control away from our board. Unfortunately, if I believe what I saw written early this morning, from what I understand it to be, we're not in a position that would be able to complete our plan as what I saw the legislation that came out this morning. Because I think while the title says lease purchase limit, I'm very concerned about the last the last sentence that says this limitation applies to levies that are required to pay for the bonds for the long-range facility plan. If that levies also includes alternative facility bond authority, then in essence what this does is creates a situation where we can only do half of our plan. And that is problematic. So we are very concerned about this particular. I'm concerned that it's here at all, frankly, given the process we went through in our community. So with that, I'll try to answer any questions that you might have.
Dr. Melcher, could you just comment on that last issue that Dr. Dixon mentioned? And I realize that we have session at 11, but there's about two or three more short issues that I'd like to bring up. Dr. Dixon mentioned that I think it was 1.8 to 1.11.
Mr. Chairman, I hadn't caught this earlier, but I think there is an issue. I did mention in my earlier testimony that I was concerned with the use of the term bonds because the lease purchase is being funded with certificates of participation, which are technically a little different from bonds. But I think what Dr. Dixon was saying was that on line 1.9, where it refers to bonds, that that could be interpreted to mean the bonds for the $59 million for the alternative facilities. And certainly I don't think it was probably the intent of the authors of this amendment to limit the total of the alternative facilities bonds and the bonds under 126C40 to that. So if you're moving forward with this, I think you'd want to probably change the reference to bonds to lease purchase or certificates of participation or something like that and avoid the potential misinterpretation of this to include the alternative facilities bonds.
Well, members, that's the problem when something gets slipped into another bill that the Committee of Jurisdiction doesn't have control over. And so I think here it's part of a tax bill now that could have an implication for a school district and the facilities that they're trying to or plan that they're trying to fulfill. Senator Olson, you had a question.
Mr. Chairman, I've got quite a few. In trying to understand, you said several things that you had 500. Dr. Dixon, you said that you've got about 500,000 square feet of space that is not used, and I can't tell. And that there are some facilities being closed. Are the facilities that you're closing above and beyond what you're trying to replace with new facilities? And is there going to be a net reduction in space? I can't tell from the list what that is or how many buildings that you have that you'll be closing and that to make that savings.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, basically, the answer is yes. We reduced the total square footage in the district by 500,000 square feet. We're doing that by, in essence, closing one high school, two middle schools, and four elementary, and then upgrading the remaining facilities. The only places where we're building new buildings is where, in fact, that the facilities that are there now are so far gone, they don't meet the investment factor is we'd have to invest so much, it's actually more reasonable to build new in those cases. So we're using existing buildings as much as we can.
And Mr. Chairman, Dr. Dixon, just kind of trying to mesh what Dr. Melcher has just said, too. This is a long-range plan, but it appears that any restriction right now somehow can't be accommodated in future legislatures. I mean, I heard that the two new buildings really didn't have any definitive plans, but the restriction in the language here would prevent those from occurring. Is this looked at as being forever, assuming that legislature never changes anything?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think first of all, the only reason the other two were not included was simply we didn't have the sites identified. We've been working on that. In fact, they're public, and the board will vote on those two sites their first meeting in June. We had planned to submit those two sites for review and comment to the department, actually, this coming summer. I think the other challenge is this, is there's so much sensitivity to who gets something and who doesn't. And if we were not able to get that, in this case, the new Lincoln Piedmont and new Western Middle School as a part of the plan, it would really damage the total plan between East and West Duluth. There is just a real sensitive issue between East and West Duluth. And these two schools that are still out are both West Duluth schools. That's my concern. I think there needs to be the idea that everyone believes the funding is there long term, even though it takes us 4 years to do all the construction, but that it will deal with the haves and have-nots, and it will create equity across the district, and no one at this point has to worry about an ongoing funding stream or future legislative action.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Nixon, so this, you are looking at this in terms of long term, but it's really 4 years through that it's going to take to just carry all of this out.
That's correct.
So now, Mr. Chairman, did Dr. Melcher's points, if those changes were made, would that actually accommodate the concerns that Dr. Nixon has expressed in terms of being able to carry out the complete plan? If that terminology were changed, then does that open that door to covering the entire plan?
It was my understanding that Dr. Melcher said it did not, because you're limited to $125 million in bonds, and you had like about a $14 million leeway, which would not cover the two facilities that were not included.
Mr. Chairman, I've visited with Dr. Melcher a little bit. I do have a sense of what the author of this language was intending. Certainly the language that the superintendent mentioned was not intended to restrict the alternative facilities bonding. And these are the kinds of issues that come up when language is getting drafted on a Saturday afternoon without the opportunity to fully have it vetted. So the certificates of participation issue is a real one that would need to be dealt with, and then that language on 1.8 through 1.11 would need to be adjusted to ensure that the intent is not to restrict the alternative facilities piece, but only the lease purchase piece. Now, the conundrum that we're in is the tax bill is closed, so to the extent that the tax bill is signed into law, I think it would be appropriate to consider this some technical adjustments for the revisor bill so that it's at least clear that the author's intent was to restrict just the lease purchase and not something broader than that.
And so, Mr. Chairman, the intent here is to restrict and prevent the two new buildings from being, it's to cover all of the plan but for those two new buildings.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I hesitate at speaking to the intent. I think the author was intending, I believe he believed that there were some public statements that were made in the Duluth area that said that they only needed $125 million in bonding or certificates of participation authority under 126C40 sub 6 to carry out the plan, and the author was hoping to constrain it to that amount and that amount only. I don't think that there was some contemplation of the two new buildings versus not.
A little addendum onto that, though, is that if you look at the House language that came in the tax bill, which had a reverse referendum, I think the intent was probably a little different. Senator Hamm?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Dixon, Dr. Dixon can also, I'm kind of getting the sense of this that what we've got here is essentially a way to finance this plan except for those two buildings. And I don't know if that was the intent in the House or not, but my question is it possible to just go to the voters and ask for approval for the additional funds to do those buildings, just have a vote on that? Is that something that would be contemplated to say, well, through this lease levy structure, we can do this, but we can't fund these two new sites, so let's just go to the voters and ask to, for approval to bond for those. Is that something that's possible, or would that be a...
Senator Hand, I think the purpose of this hearing was one that related to the jurisdiction of the committees and not necessarily, I mean, if we want the tax committee to rewrite our education I mean, that's really when we start dealing with education policy and education finance, it ought to be done in the education finance committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree. I'm just asking the question of solving this particular problem. If we've got a tax provision that got there through some other avenue rather than through this committee, which is unfortunate. The reality
maybe
is
the governor will take care of it. Who knows?
Chairman, having said that, how do you go about getting that jurisdiction back?
Well, Senator Olson, I think on the, you know, as I mentioned on the floor, I talked to Senator Bach several times. I was here until about midnight last night, and others I've talked to on the conference committee. You know, I'm hoping that we can respect the committee's jurisdiction in the future, because I don't think any chairman would like, or committee, when I speak of chairman, I speak of committee, would like to see somebody else doing what you've been assigned to as a committee. Another example is the health and safety revenue. The House put a provision in the budget balancing bill without any hearings in either the education policy or the education finance committee, just because a member had a way to put it in to stop a school district from using health and safety money until they did a $250,000 study. And it was extremely narrow, but if that's the way we want to govern, and you know, I don't think it is. I think we want our school districts with their elected boards to make decisions, and we would support those decisions as much as possible. I mean, we'd pass enough legislation here to keep them busy anyway. So, Senator Solon first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what's really important here is that Duluth has tried for 35 years to pass a long-range plan, and school boards have put forward a plan and then have backed away from it because of all the concern in the community, and they have not been able to move forward, and the school boards have lost credibility. We finally have a school board that has done a very, very thorough process of involving the community and getting input and coming up with a long-range plan, and now there is a very small vocal group, minority, who is concerned about one school closing or about perhaps the cost, or you know, they're all different issues. The school board, however, is committed to seeing a long-range plan come through. And I'm sorry, but if you could come through our schools and see the state that they're in, it's deplorable. And it's not because the district hasn't wanted to do what is necessary, but we don't, it's a patchwork type of thing, and we need to come into the 21st century. And we finally have a plan. And if the legislature now swoops in and says, okay, we don't have confidence in the school board, what is that message that it gives to the community? And that's a great concern to me, that this school board has really taken responsibility. They've stood up to some significant controversy, and they have responses to the community. It is thorough, it is responsible, it's appropriate, and I don't think it's right for us now, when the legislature put a plan in place with its wisdom of knowing how difficult it is to pass some of this of these bond referendums in communities, set a plan in place 20 some years ago. And now we're using the authority that the legislature put out there. And because the community is upset, for us to come in now and say, well, you don't have to follow those rules, we're going to change them for you. How do you move anything forward in the community?
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator Crisola. In other words, you'd be better off with current law.
Yes.
So the governor could give you a great put in hand if he vetoed the tax bill. All right, now, is this tax bill really agreed upon all the way around, so it's likely to be signed, or is it, I haven't been paying that close attention to what's going on there to know that is it likely veto, so that you're going to be plugging for that side of it.
Mr. Nauman, can you give us an update?
Mr. Chairman and members, it's my understanding that the tax bill, there were others that were in the room that were there. I think they concluded the conference committee last night at pretty late pretty early in the morning. And so I think that the conference committee report's been signed at this point, which is why I say that to the extent that this becomes law, I think it would be appropriate to look for a technical solution in the revisor bill, so at least at that point it works.
If it's signed.
Or I said becomes law.
Senator Worthen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson and Mr. Chair, I do not believe the tax bill is agreed upon at all. Is not agreed upon at all.
I left about midnight last night, and they were attempting at that time to kind of get everything closed up. And I talked to a number of our conferees. The other two issues, and I know I think I'm not sure what time session. 11. The other two issues. Thank you, Dr. Dixon.
Yes, thank you. And
appreciate your willingness to come down and talk about this. One is that I believe, and I could be stand to be corrected, but I believe we talked about the issue of the wind energy subtraction, both in the policy committee and in the finance committee division. I believe it was defeated in the committee. And I believe it was defeated twice on the floor on a roll call vote, or on a vote. And then the third time it was offered, it went on by one vote.
On the tax bill.
On the tax bill. And I believe that policy was established as part of the governor's language last year. And looking at the equity between districts, because if you look at those districts that will be rich in wind energy, they would stand to benefit, significantly over those that do not have wind energy. And so that's a provision that's in the tax bill as well. Right?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the tax conference committee agreed to put to change the existing law and eliminate that subtraction.
So, members, I think as we kind of wind this session down, we should try to be cognizant of the different committees' jurisdiction, and I don't know, as amendments are offered on the floor and everything, but I do think that it can pose some real issues, especially in the case of the facilities or the lease levy one. But any other?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hamm?
I just want to make a comment, and I appreciate very much your comments about. And I think you're making a very good point. We ought to be cognizant of that. We have delegated authority to boards, and we try to provide a general structure for them to operate. And then we should let them do that, even if we disagree, which we make, on particular judgments they make. If we give them general authority, we ought to let them do that. And I think what you're describing really is a very damaging thing for the legislature to do. And to your point about the jurisdiction of the committee participating in that, I think that's unfortunate. So I guess I don't know what the answer is in this case, but I just hope that going forward that we do a better job of both those things, keep the jurisdictions clear, but also respect the delegated authority we've given to school boards and let them make decisions even though they may turn out to be what we particularly might wish, or if we were the board, but we're not. We're not the board. And I think you make a very good point. I just hope that we, in this committee, can continue to act on those things. And I appreciate your comment as well about the jurisdiction. And I guess there's nothing we can do to, you can't pass a law to this committee and take the floor to the, tomorrow and countermand this, apparently, but I'm not sure what the solution is. But.
Well, we'll continue to think about avenues to, I mean, if this does, if the tax bill is closed up and if it does get signed by the governor, I think we definitely have problems that we have to figure out what to do. And Mr. Nolan mentioned the revisor's bill, which is a possibility. So. All right, thank you, members, for coming. Thank you. Committee is adjourned. The only, it's basically our working group solution.